The wake of congressional investigations into a wave of so-called anti-Semitism on college campuses, university administrators are bending over backwards to appease right-wing politicians and wealthy donors at the expense of civil liberties and free speech and academic freedom protections. They particularly operationalize notions of public safety and feelings of safety to mute protests over the Israeli genocide of the Palestinian people, a genocide enabled by these same universities and by the United States as a whole. Thus, we see a warped set of values and priorities wherein the most principled people are being disciplined, suspended, and expelled from campus. We're joined by Hamza El-Budali, a student protester, Nicole Morse, an activist professor, and Natasha Leonard, a journalist from The Intercept, who's been covering these cases. Let's start with the most recent developments. Natasha, could you tell us what you've learned about what's happening at Columbia?
3 days ago, the president of Columbia, Munis Shafiq, was speaking in front of Congress in the latest McCarthyite site of interrogation under the purported name of student safety and anti-Semitism. And she gave this predictable performance about how she was very keen to interrogate and name names, which I would say throw under the bus a number of her faculty members and colleagues, very respected and beloved faculty member and colleagues. The following day, over 100 students who had started an encampment on the campus lawns. So for those of you who haven't seen the faculty of Columbia, which is on the upper west side of Manhattan, it has these kind of big quad lawns. And Students for Justice in Palestine, JVP, Jewish Voice for Peace, and a broader coalition of university students had set up an encampment, staying overnight, holding teach-ins, the kind of thing that was fantastic for knowledge production amongst students in that horizontal way. But it was not a permitted protest. Some people might remember that the university had summarily suspended their JVP and SJP chapters at the end of last year in what was a kind of very striking, but I think tone-setting for what we're seeing now, move by the administration to silence pro-Palestinian dissent, even when one of the groups involved was Jewish Voice for Peace. So these groups started an encampment yesterday. The police, the NYPD, in their dozens in riot gear, are called into the university campus. They did not invite themselves in. They were invited by President Shafiq to go and take apart the encampment and specifically to arrest students that decided not to move. Over 100 students were grabbed by police officers, put in zip ties, put in this kind of series of police vans held outside, very reminiscent of the sort of repression we famously saw. I wasn't alive. None of us were paying attention to that, maybe as adults, but in 1968 in the anti-war protests on that very same campus. And amazingly, you saw lots and lots of students respond to this with righteous, rightful fury, watching their classmates who were peacefully protesting be dragged away by the cops. Even the cops in their statements, not that I'm that interested, but they even said it seemed somewhat like an overreaction when interviewed or something of that. Following that, students have refused to move. Other students have gone onto these lawns, set up more tents, continue to protest, insist upon their rights to do, the need to do, their commitment to this movement for Palestinian liberation. So all in all, I think it was this extraordinary unforced error by the administration and by the president in terms of the university's reputation for all but pro-Israel interests.
I would love to hear what Hamza has to say, but I want to insert a historical point, which is that I was alive in 1968, and a good friend of mine, Hilton, was at Columbia in 1968, and he was texting me about this. He was one of the people with Mark Rudd who took over the president's office. And what was really interesting about the encampment was they replicated some of the lettering of the original protest from 1968. And there was a great interview on Democracy Now! Of one of, I think it was Jewish Voice for Peace people, who said, Columbia is waxing nostalgic all the time about the great days of 1968 and how capacious and vibrant and passionate student activism was. Of course, that was back then. It's nicely sequestered into the past, and we won't have any of that now. But I would love to hear, Hamza, your reaction, since you were one of the people here at Stanford who was part of the 120-day sit-in. What's your reaction to seeing what's happening at Columbia? And maybe tell us a little bit about your own experience in the sit-in.
Yeah, honestly, my initial reaction was, wow, that's very similar to what we did at Stanford. Obviously, we had a sit in the center of campus, what's called White Plaza. It's like a designated free speech zone, which seems to be the same type of area that the Columbia students put their encampment. We had tents as well and signs. Unlike Columbia, the administration did not send the police to remove everything right away. Eventually, they threatened to do that after 120 days. But it was really disturbing to see how on the first day, it seems, or one of the first couple of days of the Columbia sit-in, they sent NYPD and made arrests. It doesn't seem the administration over there is even trying to listen to what the students have to say. At least Stanford administration met with the students running the sit-in a couple of times. I can't say any of the demands were met, but they did seem to be, and it, relative to Columbia, did seem to be more concerned with students. But yeah, at the end of the day, it's very similar. They cite student safety on one hand. That was how they got the Stanford sit-in to stop. They said, oh, there's student safety concerns now because the pro-Israel blue and white tent, which had set up across the street, was knocked down by the wind. And now we have to just shut down everything. But of course, if they were really concerned with student safety, they would have been doing much more to address the concerns of pro-Palestinian students. So it's just saying one thing, doing something else. Yeah.
I remember that in Stanford, we had a Muslim student run over by a car. And the university dragged us heels about doing anything about that. But I'm glad you raised the question about public safety or the instrumentalization of that. Because I was reading Columbia's statement. It was all about public safety. We're worried about these students. So could you all talk a little bit about this deployment of public safety in the most cynical way possible? I offered to teach a course on Palestinian solidarity, and my chair said, we're worried about your safety. Can we all talk a little bit about that? Maybe, Nicole, you're nodding enthusiastically.
Public safety as a concern on this issue is, of course, yes, as you said, weaponized, instrumentalized. At my campus, Florida Atlantic University, we haven't had anything like what Columbia or Stanford had. We had one single Palestinian protest on October 11th that was organized by some wonderful young women from the Muslim Student Association and the Young Arab Leaders Association. And the university brought in state troopers, riot police, and ended up arresting three people, two of whom were connected to an incident of Zionist provocation. But the representation was that there were three arrests because the pro-Palestinian students were so violent. And after that, there has not been a single protest event on campus. Student events from those two organizations have been shut down over campus safety concerns. So they've had to move all of their events off campus. We never had a functioning Students for Justice in Palestine in September. We were starting one, and I was going to be the faculty advisor. And I was told that it was really concerning that students wanted to start a Students for Justice in Palestine chapter because SJP is so dangerous. And the evidence for that is that some members of SJP, like myself, a member of Jewish Voice for Peace, believe in one person, one vote. An administrator told me that would mean an Arab majority. And so we were in the process of trying to get the chapter started when October 7th happened. And the students whose names were on the e-board were so concerned, and rightfully so, for their own safety, for being doxxed and harassed, that we decided to shut the chapter down, strip everyone's names from it. And so it is once again dormant, which it has been for years. And so this idea that student safety is supposedly threatened by a chapter of SJP because some members of SJP believe in democracy and one person, one vote, when what's actually happening is that students can't even have their name as an e-board member on a student org because they are so afraid. And again, justifiably so, given the harassment students have experienced on campus, that they will be doxxed, harassed, threats will be placed on their doors, things like that. This is the complete inversion of what's really at a question of safety. I know Natasha has talked about this in some of her work. I was just rereading an article where, you know, this issue of student safety came up in terms of Palestinian emojis, Palestinian flag emojis. So yeah, it's really concerning.
Natasha, could you talk about that?
Yes, absolutely. I wrote a column not that long ago that as these things keep escalating, feels ever more relevant. What I was trying to point out in the column is that the way in which this question of safety and comfort is being weaponized, the underlying logic that calls upon in the cases it's being applied to is that the existence of support for Palestine is being treated as necessarily a threat to Jewish students. This is how it's being framed in all these narratives. So what does that mean? And I, as a Jewish person, find this so offensive, right? Because that means that my safety is predicated on the unfreedom, the unsafety, the non-existence of Palestinian voices at my university. And obviously that's undergirding the genocidal war. And that's awful as an underlying logic. But yet with this conflation of anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism ever more entrenched in a very astroturfed way from conservative Zionist groups, this is not some sort of reflection of general feeling, it's becoming increasingly hard to respond to claims that campuses are very unsafe for Jewish students, which circulates through mainstream press. These headlines that say massive spike in anti-Semitic incidences on campuses since October 7th. I'm not suggesting there hasn't been a rise in anti-Semitism. There has, and by which I mean attacks against or harassment of Jewish people for the fact that they are Jewish. But actually, we have not seen an extraordinary spike in that, certainly not on campuses. What we've seen is a lot of Israel-critical anti-Israel activism, which is anti-war activism, anti-colonial activism. And that is trends into anti-Jewish narratives by the right, by powerful organizations like the ADL. And that narrative gets to stick in a really pernicious way, because you have New York Times articles, you have articles like the one written by Theo Baker in The Atlantic, son of the New York Times' Peter Baker, a Stanford student, presenting the campus at Stanford as overrun by brutes, imperiling Jewish students, very much not sounding like the case on the ground. But then these stories circulate. So if you are a Jewish student who isn't getting enough information firsthand, perhaps you have been told, and this is not rare, since childhood that you are identified with the State of Israel, that you need the State of Israel, that it is the most moral army in the world, etc. Of course, when you see these headlines, when you see these statistics that are massive because they conflate criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism, you do actually feel like you're living in an environment where you're under threat. I noted in this piece that I wrote for The Intercept, because I also work as a professor in New York at the New School, that surely it's our jobs to be demystifying that stuff, demystifying false narratives, demystifying propaganda, in the same way we would surely demystify and challenge rather than edify the fears of a, for example, white student who was brought up in a racist community under racist assumptions, felt afraid because of that conditioning and structure of feeling about a black student and called the cops on them. Obviously, we would challenge that and we wouldn't say, but the feeling is felt, so therefore let's validate it. We would say, no, is there something threatening here? Is there a conflation of paranoiac cultures being reiterated, or is there a genuine threat? And I think making clear what the difference is between felt concern and discomfort because of being confronted with politics and ideas you don't like, and being confronted with the harms done by a state that you might feel affinity with, it doesn't mean you're unsafe. And I think it's our job to clarify that. But what we're seeing, obviously, is administrators and powerful voices within educational spaces, aided and abetted by government forces, particularly the Republicans, no great fans of universities, I would note, very interested in upholding these narratives and justifying them. And I think that's what we're seeing as the core, sorry, slightly rambling here, but that's what we're seeing as the kind of repeat logic playing out here. And I think it's really dangerous.
Well, for a podcast entitled Speaking Out of Place, Rambling is absolutely encouraged. And I want to turn to Hamza in 1 second because he was the lead figure in that horrible article by Teo Baker. And I'm trying to retrieve, Natasha, you had a wonderful one-sentence description of that article. In fact, I just encourage everybody to read The Intercept, read all of Natasha's work, of course, but it was a wonderful description of its incoherence and irresponsibility. But just my points being, one, that in that Teo Baker article, which I was interviewed, he pressed me on a post I had made saying that students deserve to be safe, but they don't deserve to feel safe. And there was a difference, and we went into this remarkable discussion on that. But that was then picked up by one of the Zionist students at Stanford and read into the congressional record. Someplace floating around Congress is that horribly garbled quote from me. The second point I wanted to make was that both Nicole and I are proud members of the professor's watch list. The universities have no problem with having Turning Point USA, which is primarily on campus to make us literally unsafe. But they allow these chapters to thrive and they turn a blind eye, but Jewish Voice for Peace, of course not. So I just want to make those 2 points. I think, oh yes, okay, I will read the quote from Natasha. A staggeringly unbalanced feature in The Atlantic this week, written by Stanford sophomore Teo Baker, offered up a supposedly neutral narrative that treats the conflict, quote unquote, on his college campus as a battle between imperiled Jewish students and unreasoned pro-Palestinian zealots. So, Hamza, that's your cue. How did you react to seeing yourself in print that way? And again, it's exactly as Natasha said, completely unable to get your story out because of that embedding narrative. Talk a little bit about not only the experience of that article, but then what the actual facts on the ground were in terms of what you were seeing.
Yeah, there's so much to say here, but I found out about the article on a plane ride, and I was just spending the entire flight responding to nasty tweets coming my way. So I agreed to interview with Theo Baker back in, I think it was January, when there was a combating anti-Semitism event on campus. For those who don't know, there was an event where the Blue and White Tent, the pro-genocide Blue and White Tent, invited Michelle Kotler-Wunsch, I think is her name, the official Israeli special envoy for combating anti-Semitism. So basically a representative of the Israeli government, of the government that's currently committing a genocide in Gaza. They invited her to campus, and our president at the time, Richard Seller, and the provost sat with her on the same stage and basically spoke about, again, the rise of anti-Semitism on college campuses. And after the event, Theo Baker asked me to do an interview, and I said, sure. I had heard things about him not being exactly the most honest journalist, but I was like, I won't just believe the gossip. I'll give him a shot. And I responded to his questions. I thought I was very kind to him. I gave him 30 minutes of my time or more. I did notice he was asking some quite aggressive questions, trying to get some, I guess you could say, spicy material. But I thought overall, it was a pretty normal interview. And then fast forward to last month when his hit piece came out, and most of the stuff he quoted was not even from that interview. It was from things that I had said completely off the record in a private conversation with Zionists on campus. So he must have communicated with them, including Kevin, the student who was in Congress complaining about you and me. He must have communicated with him, and apparently they had private, secretly recorded me as well, which Department of Public Safety at Stanford told me was illegal. But yeah, they recorded me, sent those recordings to Theo and others in the media, and then they all just wrote hit pieces claiming that I said things that I didn't exactly say. And it's just completely false. Like, the entire article from top to bottom is a horrible caricature of campus. What makes it most dangerous, and people like Theo Baker more dangerous than the clearly pro-Israel people, is that they claim to be neutral. So they act like they don't have a horse in the race, but in actuality, they are very much pushing Zionist propaganda and demonizing pro-Palestinians. How can you write an entire piece like that on the situation of activism on Stanford's campus and not talk about the student, my friend, who was hit by a car, not talk about the student who was shoved by a current IDF soldier and student at Stanford, not talk about the truck on campus that had writing on it that said in Arabic, stand 100 meters away or we'll shoot at you, something like that. And I could go on and on. There was a genetics professor who called students at the sit-in terrorist supporters or useful idiots. There's alumni who are calling Palestinian students, threatening to get them expelled. There's the defamation, the doxing, the chalk that some Zionist Jewish students had written around the pro-Palestine sit-in and tried to frame them as if they had said something that they hadn't said. And yeah, the list goes on. There's so many things, and he didn't mention a single one of those, but then manufactures supposed danger from someone like me who's supposedly calling for the assassination of the president, which is not what I said. By the way, the story behind that is the Zionist students who were secretly recording me came up to me and started asking me all sorts of dangerous questions. Do you support ISIS? Do you support Al-Qaeda? Do you want us dead? Do you think Biden should be killed because he's doing a genocide? And I answered all the questions honestly, but of course they just take clips and out of context quotes. Theo probably has the full audio of it. It was an hour-long conversation I was having on the street with some Zionists. They could publish the whole audio if they wanted to be fair and let the community decide who's the extremist. Was it me or the students I was talking to? But they just take some quotes and paint the picture they want to paint. So it's very disingenuous, very bad journalism.
So speaking of journalism, Natasha, what is that? How does that resonate with you, what Hamza just described and your other experiences covering similar cases?
There's a certain continuity in what we've seen with what gets considered neutral journalism, the objectivity norm, as Michael Shudson describes it, playing out certainly on this issue where you've got this performance of two sides that just ends up obviously reinscribing existing business, and they are pretty uniformly in the establishment press, pro-Israel bias, and then covering for that kind of ideological entrenchment, but then also drawing all these really dangerous false equivalences, which to echo what you were saying, David and Hamza, in terms of who's actually being harmed. So the woman who was run over at Stanford, your friend, I'm sorry, hope she's doing okay, students on Columbia, at Columbia, who on campus, and two other students who are former Israeli military members, but current Columbia students, sprayed what is believed to be skunk gas. So like a chemical substance on these students at a rally, which left, I think, over 12 people needing to get hospital care for nausea and skin pain. And this is over 80 days ago, and there's been no resolution to this. It's under a police investigation, and these two students have been asked to not be on campus. At the very least, it was a chemical attack. But when you read the mainstream press coverage, oh, and let's also not forget the three young men who were wearing keffiyeh and shot, leaving one paralyzed. And we're not talking about a student here, but an 8-year-old baby who was stabbed and killed in October. But then you get these articles being like, rise of anti-Semitism and Islamophobia and anti-Palestinian sentiment. So it's, one is students sad because they decide and insist on reading the chant, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, as an attack on them. Or, as was anonymously leaked by a Columbia social work school student, were told that putting a Palestine flag emoji on their Zoom was a risk of creating a trauma response in other students, listed these things, listed alongside like severe physical harm, doxing, calling someone a terrorist can risk their ability to stay in this country. That is an act of criminalization and aligning with state authoritarian forces, which anyone at an educational facility should be, and this is not just on the issue of Palestine and the Palestinian exception, should be deeply worried in growing up and living and working under the war on terror of what it is to bandy around words like that. And instead, in the name of safety and truth-telling, these words are being bandied around with abandon. No, it is really bad, and it is certainly being echoed in most mainstream coverage. The other thing I did want to point out about how this is being covered, and I do think the way Baker titled his hit piece against you guys and others, is that he called it the war on campus. And you see these kind of things like war on campus. The war on campus is the obliteration of every single institution to rubble of higher education, university, and many other sites of knowledge production in Gaza by the Israeli military in the last 8-10 months. So that's the war on campus and the war on intellectual life. But instead, it's a student waved a Palestinian flag, that's the war on campus. So this amount of deprioritization, which leads to dehumanization, is dehumanization, is really appalling. And the press, as they are in their historic reporting on Israel, is complicit.
Nicole, I'd like to hear your thoughts on this.
This is such an important question. And I think for me, I have been thinking a lot about the Palestine exception, which certainly exists, but also I think is less an exception than it is a kind of harbinger of what is to come. And I'm thinking about this in the context that, as you noted, Natasha, there's this protection for certain people's feelings, but a lack of protection for other people's feelings. And in Florida, we've been confronting that with dueling legislation. One law that was put in place in 2022 forbids professors from shielding students from things that would make them uncomfortable. And what was very clear in the debate in the legislature is that what was meant there is a professor can't ask a student to use the correct pronouns for a fellow student, can't ask a student to refrain from using racist slurs. So we're not allowed to shield students from things that might make them uncomfortable. We have to allow them to encounter things that would make them uncomfortable. And then the next year in 2023, a law was passed that said that we cannot make students feel bad about historical injustices that might have been committed by people similar to them. Excuse me. I'm getting over a cold because I was arrested Monday during the tax day actions, and Miami police have signs everywhere in the jail that says mask, protect against COVID-19. But of course, when we asked for masks, we were told they're not allowed. The kind of continual state processes of baffling and subverting our well-being. I guess for me, I just want to always think about these things as not contradictory, but actually revealing an underlying consistency. And so in Florida, this question of feelings, the feelings that need to be protected are the white students' feelings. We can't make them feel bad. And the feelings that cannot be protected, that can't be shielded, are all the other students' feelings. And it's not only, of course, on race. And then, as you pointed out, David, Turning Point is allowed on campus. And that's not a contradiction to the Muslim Student Association being forced off campus, or JVP and SJP at Columbia, because, in fact, this is all consistent. And again, I don't want to dismiss the Palestine exception. Certainly in my case, I was running our Center for Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies, and I was fighting all of these anti-gender studies laws in Florida. And I was doing so in such a way that people were suggesting I might be able to think about being faculty senate president someday. I would have a place at this institution. And the instant that I was arrested in October for being at a ceasefire rally, suddenly my status at the institution was completely obliterated because I was now seen as a terrorist sympathizer. But all this to say that I think it's only an exception when that is useful, because the donors who wanted me removed, they also have long wanted to remove trans studies from the curriculum of the Center for Women and Gender Studies. They've never gendered me correctly. They are extremely hostile to LGBT issues, even though they've had to go along with it. And then when we look at other kind of tendencies, again, like Zionists and homophobia, transphobia, these are deeply intertwined, which isn't to say that there isn't a significant problem of homophobia that queer Palestinian activists are fighting within their communities. But this idea that somehow Palestine is the one exception, I think could be a dangerous assumption, because they're testing out what they can do in terms of restricting academic freedom, in terms of restricting free speech on this issue, and then it's going to apply everywhere else. And again, in Florida, in 2019, a law was passed that made criticizing the state of Israel illegal for professors, or made it, you know, definitionally anti-Semitic. And there was no outrage. Next thing we know, a few years later, suddenly everything else that we do is being banned. And I think there's a way that you have to see those as connected, that there was the kind of the test case of, would people fight back and say, we have to be able to teach truthfully this issue of the history of the state of Israel? No, people were willing to let it slide. And then the right wing expanded. So yeah, again, without dismissing the way that Palestine solidarity is exceptionalized and attacked, I also think it's showing us what is desired by fascists, by right wingers, who are seeking to control more and more of our thought and our speech.
That's such a remarkable statement. We had Nora Ericott on the show recently, and she was talking about international humanitarian law. And she said, Israel's rewriting international humanitarian law. If we let Israel do it, it opens the door for every other opportunistic state to crawl through that space. So you're exactly right in all those respects. We also had Neve Gordon on from the UK, and he said something that was very interesting. He said, the UK doesn't have the same kind of protection of academic freedom, free speech as the US. It's much more vicious, and people who are dissenting and pro-Palestinian are much more vulnerable. However, the UK does not have the donor culture the United States does. So I'd like to talk about the weight of donor culture, which opens the door for them to drive through all these things. And of course, most horribly in Florida, but you're right, it's viral. So I'd like everybody to comment about the donor culture and the way these university presidents are abrogating their responsibility to have universities have some sort of autonomy, but rather opening the door for all this sort of, all these, if I might say, infections from the donor class and the capitalist class, acting in conjunction with right-wing politicians.
Actually, I was going to also ask Nicole a question that relates,
yeah,
and also definitely want to hear from Hamza on this too. But obviously, I think what's interesting is that it's this constitution you're seeing of what was a kind of pre-existing undoing of public education, undoing of the university, of using the manufactured anti-trans panic to take away power from teachers, to take away power from teachers' unions, the conjured critical race theory panic, all of which were abilities towards further privatization, the privatization of education, care, breaking down of union power, however beleaguered it already is. Those are the conditions of possibility for them to fire people more easily. The adjunctification of our institutions, meaning it's so easy to not rehire someone and give someone no recourse, make it impossible for people to find jobs. And so what we're seeing here is that if you've got a right-wing agenda, a donor class agenda, and the allegiances they have, it's quite, even when it's been difficult to fire certain people, we've seen things, especially in Florida, the kind of where these things are, DeSantis's plan is really a blueprint, you've seen like whole departments being shut down and things. Whereas now, this claims of anti-Semitism thing is this whole nother like aperture. So it's like, great, we're doing this anyway. Ooh, now we've got this ideal to, yeah, to enforce this type of ideological hegemony that doesn't, you know, there's no point, as you say, pointing out hypocrisy. And I was curious about the kind of feeling you have in Florida of, and I'm almost being rhetorical here, of the sort of people that were saying, we've really got to fight back against DeSantis's plan, seeming like allies as relates to certain things like LGBTQ speech and those sort of laws. Have you seen those people stand up for Palestinian voices too? Because of course the right is going to be hypocritical and conservative and reactionary, liberal voices perhaps. Have you seen people that were maybe willing to stand up to that attack on universities in one way also stand up now, or not so much?
I'd say not so much. And this is where the idea of the Palestine exception has a lot of power. But I also think it somewhat has power because we talk about it all the time. So it's always the third rail. And on campuses across Florida, people have been very clear, oh, I can't speak up about this. This is the one thing that will risk my job. And that may or may not be true. And I'm certainly leaving my position, not because I have been fired, but before I get fired, because I do think that there's a way that the donor class is going to be particularly outraged about the work that I've done on this issue. And this work is not professional work. This is personally in a private capacity. I belong to an anti-Zionist synagogue, and through that, I'm connected to Jewish Voice for Peace. And through that, I participate in civil disobedience, which is something that no one in the Florida government seems to really appreciate, but it has a certain constitutional status. But I think the issue is that, like you said, these are all actually connected. And the same organizations that are funding the bans on drag performance that were attempted to be enacted in Florida and are being attempted in other states, some of that funding is the same funding source that then promotes repression of Palestinian speech, supposedly to protect against anti-Semitism. And all of this is connected through these dark money organizations and donors who are very clear in what they want. And what they want is a white nationalist, Christian supremacist country. Jews are only an object for them. We're used in order for them to say, look, we're actually not as racist as you say, because we protect Jews because we believe in Israel. But of course, as many of us know, Christian Zionists are really only interested in Israel in the terms of the role it plays in their fantasy of the end times. And I think we see this same thing in terms of LGBTQ people and Zionists, where Zionists will participate in the brand Israel pinkwashing, that Israel is such a wonderful place for LGBTQ people. But the instant you're a queer person who is speaking up for Palestine, they describe in lurid detail their fantasies about how they want you to be harmed and destroyed. So this idea that certain types of people are merely objects and are being objectified in order to achieve a larger goal, I think is something that's really important for Jews to keep in mind as we hear this conversation about anti-Semitism, where anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism are conflated. I still haven't gotten over the experience of facing a non-Jewish person, a white man, who asked me, but how are your beliefs not anti-Semitic? You have to explain to me how you're not anti-Semitic. And here I am, someone who's, you know, very publicly Jewish and very publicly observant. And yet I could make those statements, and I have gotten away with my anti-Zionist positions much more so than a person of color would have, than especially a Palestinian, Muslim, or Arab colleague would have. And so to come back to your question, Natasha, I think that's something that's been really interesting to see, that very few people have been willing to speak up about Palestine, even fewer than were willing to speak up about the other ways that education is being restricted in Florida. Even ultimately, many people are very willing to just cut race out of their syllabus, to cut a word that is disfavored, and to say that by doing so, they're saving what really matters, quote unquote. And so I think this idea that what we're seeing is a gathering repression that's using every tool available is really, that's what we're fighting. And the vanguard is, how far can they go when it comes to repressing pro-Palestinian speech?
No greater sign of the irony is that one of the people leading the charge in Congress is a proponent of the Great Replacement Theory. I mean, how does that sit with people? And it just, it's covered minutely in the press, but it should be constantly out there.
Yeah, I just think it's unfortunate that donors wield so much power over universities. One of the things that I always say when I talk to Zionists on campus is, I'm just asking for you to be consistent. I know I'm not going to change your mind and make you pro-Palestine in this conversation we're going to have. That's going to take a much longer amount of time. But at the very least, I expect everyone to be consistent and just honest about where they stand. So if you think that the donors should have a lot of influence over universities, then just say so. If you think that universities should crack down on pro-Palestinian speech, then be honest about it. Don't brand yourself as a free speech advocate. Some of the most free speech absolutists are the ones who are cracking down the hardest on anything that's remotely pro-Palestine. And just they're not even able to own up to what they really believe. And that makes it so much less respectable. Like, you can have an unpopular view, but be honest about it and say, this is what I think. And then people know where you stand, and then we move on. But they'll say one thing and they'll just double speak or have specific rules that they only apply to Palestinian or Arab or Muslim students and not to everyone else. So that's really unfortunate. And I think a lot of the people who are actually well-intentioned, or at least relatively well-intentioned, and I think even some of the admin at Stanford can fall into this camp, they're so concerned about what the donors think or what certain people think, and they don't realize how much support they would have if they were consistent and actually did say what they really think on the issue. I'm not denying that donors have a lot of power and a lot of influence, but the world is changing. It's not the year 2000 anymore. That was the year I was actually born. But I know that back then it was way harder to be pro-Palestinian. On college campuses, I've spoken to students who were protesting back then, and they were saying, like, we could never do the stuff that you guys are doing today with the sit-ins and that kind of stuff. The student populace has certainly shifted a lot, I think, in the next decade or two. It's only going to keep shifting. And at some point, it's going to reach the level of administration. Yeah, I would just encourage those people who are afraid of backlash to also make sure that when they're like doing their cost benefit analysis, they're also looking at how many people would actually agree with them and support them if they were to be honest.
I really want to underscore that, Hamza, because on campus, and this is not unique to Stanford, but we had the initial after October 7th, bland or non-statement, whatever. And then pressure was exerted on our president. And he came out and he said he condemned Hamas. And that was it. And then he said, okay, now from now on, we're going to be neutral. And that was not unusual. There was these little momentary blips where they gave that concession to the donors. And then they clamped up. And of course, our new president is saying no statements about anything. And I wrote Salah recently after all the terrible data came out about Scholasticide and said, leaving aside the politics, these are our colleagues. What other country would we allow this absolute decimation of not just the infrastructure, but the human beings without saying anything, so that we're not issuing any more statements? But I'd like to talk about going forward now. And I know, Nicole, you wanted to get something in first, but in general, after you make your point, Nicole, I'd like us all to talk about how do we, as Hamza said, how can we use this moment to build for the future? Because Hamza, I have to say, the sit-in changed Stanford. There is no turning back. What you all did for the 120 days transformed the place. And I mentioned this in my Al Jazeera article. When Salah said, okay, you have to dismantle everything in 8 hours, 500 people came out. I've never seen that happening at Stanford. So you started something that will never end. It's just morphed into other things. But Nicole, why don't you make your point, and then we can talk, wrap up by talking about activism in general. Yeah.
Oh, and this can actually lean toward the question of what can we do? Because one thing I wanted to ask Hamza about is, if I understand correctly, and of course, I'm relying on public comments that I know may not be accurate, one of the acts that you participated in is holding a sign that said, ask me about jihad. And for me, I remember 10 years ago, when I first became involved with Jewish Voice for Peace, I went to rallies where people chanted from the river to the sea, and they chanted Intifada. And I had been raised to fear those slogans, and I felt very nervous about them. And I would look around and say, what do these people mean? But I was getting to know people, and I was asking them, when you say that, what do you mean? And now, you know, I'm incredibly comfortable with those slogans and feel that they're very empowering, but it was necessary to have those conversations. It was necessary for me to be willing to be uncomfortable and ask those questions. And so, yeah, I'd love to ask you, if you don't mind, if I were to come up to you and ask you about jihad, what would you say?
First, I would say thank you for actually being honest and asking me rather than recording me secretly and trying to get me blasted. So jihad is it's a beautiful concept in Islam. It's mainstream Islam. It's not some like extremist interpretation that only fringe groups like ISIS believe. Obviously, fringe groups like ISIS have their interpretation on jihad. They have their interpretation on everything in Islam, and it's very contorted, and the vast majority of Muslims in the world disagree with it and have condemned it and distanced themselves from that. But jihad is mentioned in the Quran, it's mentioned in the Hadith, it's all over Islamic literature, and it basically just means to strive or to struggle and the path of God. And that can take many different forms. There is a armed struggle. So there is a sense in which it can be used to refer to a sort of combative or military type of struggle. And naturally, whenever you have resistance groups around the world who are Muslims, and especially when they're being persecuted by non-Muslims, they will refer to what they're doing as jihad. And so you see this in the decolonial movements in Algeria and Morocco, in Afghanistan. Really any Muslim country in their decolonial period will always have a group that are referred to as the Mujahideen. And there was a time where this country was actually funding the Mujahideen in Afghanistan because they happened to align with their foreign policy interest or their anti-Soviet interest. There's really nothing scary about it, about the word itself. Obviously, there are going to be extremists in the Muslim community, just like there are in every community, Christian community, Jewish community, Hindu community. But to just say that the word itself is inherently dangerous and that I can't speak about it openly or can't say words like Sharia, which again is another mainstream Islamic concept. It just means it's the divine law. It's similar to the concept of halakhic law in Judaism. Again, you cannot just criminalize this word or demonize this word and say anybody who says Sharia law is good or wants Sharia law is a radical. And we see people on the far right always making that argument. People like Ben Shapiro claiming that, oh, all of these Muslims say that they want Sharia law, therefore they're all radical. So I'm happy that I'm able to say that on Stanford's campus and not get in trouble. That's the very least that the administration can do, is to, again, be consistent. And if they're going to allow Zionists to preach their positions and spread their misinformation, then at the very least, I should be able to say what I want to say, as long as I'm not saying anything illegal. And so that was part of the reason I did that, actually, was just to say, because this blue and white tent that had set up there was really using like Islamophobia as a main talking point in their materials. They had a book in their tent that was like about radical Islam. It wasn't even about Palestine, Israel. And of course, if you read that book, it's just talking about mainstream Islam. It's talking about concepts like jihad. It's not actually talking about necessarily terrorism, but they'll paint it that way. And then they'll connect it to Hamas. And then they have their whole Hamas equals ISIS campaign. And then they'll go on about how this whole issue just goes back to Islamic extremism or fundamentalism or radicalism, whatever term they use. So I thought it was important to combat that narrative and to show that I'm willing to combat that narrative. I'm not going to be silenced by their fear mongering and their threats of intimidation that you're not going to get a job. We're going to record you. We're going to send it to our network. We're going to go to Canary Mission. I was like, I don't care. Go to Canary Mission. In fact, I'll put Canary Mission on my resume if you want. It's not a deterrent anymore. Maybe 10, 20 years ago, that was going to stop people. But things are changing. So people who are actually honest and can have conversations about jihad or Sharia or Hamas or whatever the hot button issue is, I always welcome those discussions. And I've had lots of great discussions, including with some Zionists on campus. But then there's those people who are there to just try and get quotes for their hit piece. And that's unfortunate.
I also just wanted a brief side point, but I don't know if you saw during the congressional hearing, just talking about like the ignorance about certain terms, but then that are still just used and weaponized. The congresswoman who kept asking, so do you condemn the infantada or empanada or something? I think her name's Lisa McLean. She's a Republican congresswoman from Michigan. And it was just like just the sheer disinterest in information being factual or historically situated. Or so you're just like, okay, the idea that we have to take this seriously because it's government is unbearable. But in terms of going forward, so it's this horrible but hopeful mixture. And I suppose that is like a conjuncture in crisis, but maybe in a good way, is that, yes, you've got this silencing and people are unable to teach around certain things or because of certain connections, and that harms knowledge production and narratives that get written. You actually just have the decimation of thinkers and historians and knowledge producers in Palestine because they've been displaced and slaughtered and have no more institutions to work in. So that's the kind of unbearable side that makes it hard to feel positive. But then you do look at things like just even at Columbia now, the students get arrested and then students who weren't necessarily even part of the encampment at first flood in and restart the encampment and keep going. And the investment that people have in keeping Palestinian voices being heard, both by republishing, having works translated, publishing Palestinian voices in magazines like Lux, like The Baffler, like Parapraxis, Jewish Currents. And I'm part of a group called WAWOG, Writers Against the War on Gaza. And that's hundreds of people who are working on this and trying to build solidarity. And so there is a slight, I think it's called like the Streisand effect, when there is this repression, people are like, don't talk about, it's like, we shall continue, won't stop talking about Palestine and what it means to be in an internationalist movement, which also is recognizing that the other point I wanted to briefly make to circle back a little bit was, I think if we fixate just on the donor class rather than the kind of state infrastructure that co-constitutes it, we could get a little lost, a bit like if we only focused on private prisons, when in fact, most of the violence of the carceral state are state prisons. Because obviously you look at somewhere like Germany, where most educational cultural institutions are completely state funded, and the repression of Palestinian voices there is, you know, it's very much even hold my beer compared to the US repression. And same in the UK. I think what we have to be reckoning with and understand our struggle is internationally against is just as much the kind of hegemonic framework state forces as much uphold that our donors' billionaire interests certainly tech Silicon Valley billionaire interests. But it's not like if we got rid of the donor system, we will have freed Palestinian voices on US campuses. But it seems like people will just keep the struggle going and are being extraordinarily brave. And I'm so proud of the students who are fighting this. And it's obviously lovely to stand with them.
It's a great statement. Hamza and Nicole, do you want to add any?
I'll just thank Hamza for your answer to my question and say that for me, one of the things that's been really powerful and similar to what Natasha said, it's both positive and negative, and it's hard to even imagine anything as a positive when we see the videos coming out of Gaza and the West Bank every day and just know how extreme the violence is. But amid this genocide, we're seeing that people are speaking out, and the intensifying crackdown to me is an expression of the increasing desperation of a system that is recognizing that it's losing. And that is horrifying. And it's particularly horrible that the brunt of this is being borne by Palestinians in Gaza, in the West Bank, and then, of course, in the diaspora. But nonetheless, there is that sense that the system would not be reacting with this extreme intensification. And that was certainly what I was feeling this week, hearing about what happened at Columbia. If those in power felt confident that they were in control, and that they were going to be able to continue the settler colonial project unimpeded by the energy of protest and the people's voices. So I do think that we have to keep bringing people in to the fight and into the movement. And to do that, we have to have conversations. We have to be able to speak to each other, understand each other. And I'm grateful for this opportunity to speak with all of you.
I agree with what's been said about the importance of speaking to each other and being open-minded. So thank you for inviting me on this podcast. There haven't been many that have tried to speak to me. Unfortunately, a lot of the media is just following Zionist propaganda. And the more platforms like this where we can get our narrative out, the better it is for everyone.
I want to thank you all so much for being on the show. And this has been a wonderful conversation. I share both your sense of despair, but also of immense hope. So have a wonderful weekend and the fight continue. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much. Thank you, David.
Thank you. Such an honor.
Thank you for the work you do. And I hope that you're not dealing with too much horrible backlash as it goes on. But yes, let's stay in solidarity and conversation. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.